In approximately 40 minutes, we will break, give an hour or two each way. Sorry I was a little late. I did miss the University Boulevard driving by, and I should have had my monitor on, but I've marked the places in my mind now where to turn. When Donna and Alan and I were at Harding in 64, the fall, there were approximately only 1,200 students at that time. And we were all able to meet in the Harding Auditorium. And for Alan and me, Alan and I had a close proximity to the auditorium. It was right by a West Dorm, an old army barracks that had been moved in there and used, and there was another one identical to it next to us. And we lived in the one closest to the Harding Auditorium. George Benson was still president of the school at that time. And for several years running, we had been meeting on Saturdays, classes on Saturdays. It's almost, it seems unreal to think back that it was like that, but many of you know why it was like that. Preachers, students, and faculty, we'd be gone out to preach somewhere by railway or car or riding with someone else to their appointments on Sundays. And sometimes it took a good while to get back. So Dr. Benson and others made it available that we didn't meet on classes on Monday, but we met them on Saturday. Now, the very next year, Dr. Gainis became president, and we went to the Monday through Friday routine and were off on Saturdays. Well, one Saturday morning, while we were in that first year of Dr. Gainis's tenure, Alan was scheduled to play ping pong at 8 o'clock with Neil Pryor in the gymnasium. And Saturdays C were free at that time. The previous year, we were in classes on Saturday. And I must have awakened early, and I knew he had this appointment. But I must have gone to the bathroom, and I think, I'll pull a trick on Alan. And he had his watch on his arm in the bed, and I set it an hour early. I set his alarm an hour early, so he thought that, would think that his appointment was at 8, and he was going to make it there and play ping pong with Dr. Pryor. Well, it was actually 7 o'clock, and so he gets up early, gets dressed, goes to the dining hall, and he came back, and of course they weren't open. He came back and sat on his bed, and he looked at his watch and looked at the other thing. I set every clock in the room to be an hour early. This is a mean trick, isn't it? But he still got to play with at the right time, because we still had that hour to play. But he sat there on the bed, and he would look at the watch and things and trying to figure that out. The dining hall wasn't open. Well, he'll just not have breakfast, but he's waiting around to meet Dr. Pryor, and he goes over there, and of course he's not there at the appointed time. But he was able to go later, because after he was sitting on the bed there, and I just burst out laughing because he couldn't figure that out. I felt bad about it, because he's such a good guy. I never pulled a trick on him like that again. And I don't recall him ever trying to get me back either. Isn't he a good guy? I want to encourage you at the beginning of this lesson today to read more church history, Christian history. And let me give you some reasons why. I'd like for us to study some dates and some significant things that happened leading up to the Restoration Movement. Lord willing, I'll get with Nancy and we'll make you a couple of pages front and back for a handout for today's lesson, what we're going to stress today. But let me begin first with showing you some examples why we ought to read Christian history. One of the earliest people that we commonly mention who was an early restorer was John Glass. He lived in Scotland, and he was preaching, of course, each Sunday in the Church of Scotland. He lived at Dundee, and in the year 728, in the pulpit, he said, "The Scottish Church is unscriptural. There is no justification for a church and state, one church and a state working together to try to interpret and promote Christianity." Of course, he was fired from his pulpit. He was deposed. About 10 years later, after working through the law courts, they said, okay, you can preach, but you can't preach in the Church of Scotland. Now this man, John Glass, read up on him. It's wonderful today that we are able to reprint all of his books electronically. You can go on the web and look up John Glass with only one S. His son-in-law was Robert Sandeman, and we commonly hear these two names. Now, why do I bring John Glass up? He knew Hebrew, he knew Greek, he knew the Bible, but he knew church history too. And he read a lot of church history, and he wrote about church history. Alexander Campbell, in his studies, go back and check it out. He studied the Bible, he studied Greek, Hebrew, and how to read the Old Testament and the New Testament in their original languages. But guess what else he studied a lot of? Church history. I don't know about the term church history. That may scare some people off, but Christian history, that is anything related to what calls itself Christian. Read that literature and you'll learn a lot. And if you'll look closely, you'll find things that many historians won't write down. That story, for instance, about the vote I mentioned, 25-25, and the moderator voted for sprinkling, and because of that one vote, millions and millions of people used sprinkling as a mode of baptism rather than what the text said. Now, how does that come up? How do they justify that? They have what you call a covenant. And when they're reading the Bible, they're reading the Bible through the eyes of that covenant. Covenantalism is what it is. They can't write a paragraph. They can't speak in the pulpit or teach in a class without very often mentioning covenant. And so when you say to these people, "Did you know that the New Testament teaches immersion?" And they said, "Yeah, we know that." "Well, why don't you go back?" "Well, in our church covenant, it says such and such." And they try to justify it in that way. It's a way of reading the Bible. So when they read the Bible. They said, we have agreed and we have signed a covenant before God and man that this is the way we're going to do it. And so by that vote, they decided to use sprinkling. Is that a way to read the Bible? It's not the best way to read the Bible. Did that system nourish some of our early restorers? Indeed it did. Alexander, Thomas Campbell, Walter Scott, Martin W. Stone, all four of them were covenantalists. And that kept them for a while from reading what the text is actually saying. So, John Glass stressed, read church history. Know what has happened. Alexander Campbell stressed it. We all know Thomas Jefferson and the importance in the United States of America. When it came for his tombstone being inscribed, he said, don't put on my tombstone that I was president of the United States. People will know that. He knew. But he said, do put on my tombstone that I was the author of the church and state separation clause in Virginia. Now, some people don't know that. Many people do. But he established the University of Virginia. And when they built the sidewalks there, he said, don't build the sidewalks first. Watch where it marked where the students walk from class to class. He said, and then you see those paths? He said, then put walks that way. Smart man. And those of us who've gone through Monticello, his home, saw how many remarkable things he made. But he was the one started the University of Virginia. And he said, I want all of the ministry students at the University of Virginia to read J.B. Priestley's church history about the corruptions that have come into the church. Every year, I want them to read that. And as the father of that school, he had some influence, of course. You see what he was doing? He wanted ministry students to know church history and the corruptions that have crept in. I think you and I ought to do that. I don't know where to start. Well, the internet is very helpful, but they're helpful books. Don't depend on just one church history. I was interested when I got my doctorate in knowing about Anabaptists, those who first advocated separation of church and state, those who realized, you know, a baby, an infant, is not the candidate, the right candidate for being a Christian. We can't find an example of it. These men, the first Anabaptists that I think are really outstanding ones, were in Switzerland. And they studied under Ulrich Zwingli. Ulrich Zwingli he became the preacher at the Grossmünster, that is the big church in downtown Zurich. And he taught them, when he came out of Catholicism and began to preach in Zurich, he preached all the way through the book of Matthew, verse by verse, and he read it in the Greek, and he lectured out of it. And he taught those young men that were wanting to learn to do things like he was doing it, preach right out of the Bible, and learn the Greek and the Hebrew. He taught them, go right to the text. And he'd get up in the pulpit and preach right out of the New Testament. That was very unusual for a former Catholic to do that. But he taught them, don't do things that you can't find scripture for. Let's go back to the text. Well, that was a good thing. And so they came to him one day, Felix Mance, Conrad Grable, George Bluecoat, Blaurock, and others, and they said, Brother Zwingli, we cannot find where we should baptize our infants. And you taught us, go by the text. What does the Bible say? And he agreed with them at first. But the town council in Switzerland, in Zurich, and each of the the councils of the cantons or the counties of Switzerland had the supervision in religion. And so the town council of Zurich said, no, wait just a minute, Dr. Zwingli. We think we ought to have a disputation on this like we've done on the Mass and other things, and we've thrown the Mass out. We need to check this out and have a disputation on infant baptism. So when they had that disputation, they brought in Dr. Balthazar Hubmaier, an Anabaptist, who wrote a book on baptism. And he had decided, this is not scriptural to be having infant baptism. Well, they brought him as a prime speaker, and others spoke. And then the town council chose Zwingli to speak on the other side of the question. And the town council said, we think we ought to go by the ancient Justinian law code. Justinian was a man who codified all Roman laws, including all Roman Catholic laws by that time. This is around the year 675. And guess what the penalty was? If you brought up your child and did not have him or her baptized, death. That was the penalty. What if you grow up and you realize, I was baptized as an infant, but I've read the New Testament backwards and forwards. I can't find any example anywhere of a child being baptized. So I'm just not going to do it. Guess what the penalty was in the Justinian law code for not doing that? Death. And the town council in Zurich, Switzerland, had the disputation on both sides of the issue. Then they decided in council, we're going to keep infant baptism. And we're going to institute the ancient penalty regarding infant baptism. If you're baptized when you've already been baptized as a child, you get baptized as an adult, death. And so, after the disputation was over, several of these Anabaptist men, who were disappointed, of course, in Zwingli, went to Felix Mance's mother's house, and I've located that spot in Switzerland. And in that home, they were discussing, what are we going to do? They told us strictly, no more Bible studies outside of the church building. It's against the law. And if you get baptized when you were baptized as an infant, death, and we're going to enforce it. What are they going to do? These are things you read in church history, and I think we ought to know. Felix Mance said to Conrad Grable and Felix Mantz's mother's house where they were meeting. Said, "Conrad, baptize me." Now, that's a famous event. And you can go to that place today where, along the little street where her house was and where he asked that question. They thought at that time sprinkling was the mode. They hadn't even really considered immersion yet. They're just thinking about the candidate. And I appreciate them restoring the candidate, the proper candidate. You see what's happening? Restoration is coming back a little bit at a time. But it's extremely dangerous. And a lot of people got killed. Conrad Grable took some water, effused him, sprinkled or poured, and then they took turns about sprinkling one another. And there was the reinstitution, the restoring of the proper candidate. They didn't have the mode right. And those that descend from these people, like Mennonites, the Amana colony out in Kansas and elsewhere, and others who descend historically from these Zurich brethren, they were called Anabaptists. Many of them continue to sprinkle. Some of them have discovered immersion. But here is the restoration of the candidate. I believe it's important. Alexander Campbell put it like this: baptism of infants and the practice thereof has brought more carnality into the church of our Lord than any one thing. I thought when he said that, that's an overstatement. But the more I thought about it, the more I see it is correct. In other words, you could grow up and someone would ask you, "Were you a Christian?" "Yes, I'm a Christian. Because I was sprinkled. My mother and daddy tell me I was when I was just a little baby, 8 days of age." And you might never come to the point where you confess and confirm you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, the Messiah. And yet you're a Christian. So these people I've mentioned, John Glass, Alexander Campbell, and others, think it's important to read Christian history to see what things have been done. And frankly, how many unscriptural things has come in. I have a slate of things here I would like to mention today. I know I can't get with them all and get to them all, but Nancy and I will give you a list of these that I've brought up, and we may have opportunity to refer to a few of them in the other two classes this week. Here's what I'm going to start out with, this statement, in regard to these things I'm about to bring up. Restoration will continue. It will continue for the same reasons it first arose. That when you see these events and compare them to the New Testament, you'll see that they don't measure up. And these things contrast, make a contrast between the way restorers read the Bible and the three other types in the world today of reading the Bible. One is covenantalism. I've already mentioned covenantalism. You're reading the Bible text through those eyes. There's another thing called confessionalism. You may not have heard of it described in that way, but here's where you confess to a body of doctrine which has been agreed to by stated institutionalized interpreters. And it goes like this. And these people are Catholics, Anglicans, several Lutherans, and several others, high church type people. And they mentally assent to a body of doctrine. They might not know what it says in the least, but they agree to it. And here's the way it might go in a conversation. What does your religious group teach about such and such? And they'll say, I don't know. My priest could answer that question, or I could find out for you if you'd like. Well, do you believe the system? Oh, yes. Yeah, it's the best in the world. Well, what does it teach on such and such? Well, I knew that at one time, but I've forgotten. I don't know. I don't go to church but once a year, maybe, etc. This is called mental assent, and it's changing faith, the idea of New Testament faith, to mental assent. Oh, yes, I believe in that body of doctrine. We're the best in the world on that. That's confessionalism. And so when people read the Bible, they're reading it through the eyes of confessionalism. There's another type, main type of Bible reader that oppose to restorationism, and that is mysticism. Quakers, for instance, they're not as popular today as they used to be in the Reformation, but their theory is, I'm baptized in my heart, but I'm not baptized with water because that's not as important. What's important is in the heart. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? They said that there's been so much controversy about water baptism that we're sick of that. And so I'm just baptized in my heart. What about the Lord's Supper? We don't literally take the Lord's Supper. There's been so much confusion over that and so much controversy. That's a controversial thing. We take the Lord's Supper in our heart. This is a type of mysticism. Some of your religious associates and friends are mystics. They might not ever go to church, but they claim some kind of Christianity. That's another type. And when they're reading the Bible, if they do, they'll read it through the eyes of mysticism. Now, the first thing I'd like to mention is a man by the name of Berengarius, Berengarius. If any of you have one of those Macintosh or Apple pigtails that I can plug into this little thing right here, that little spot, I can plug into the pulpit and I can run this thing from down here, but I emptied all of my pocket in my computer bag so as to bring the cord and other things, and I left that at home, and I shouldn't have done that. The Pope at that time was Leo IX, and he executed the man, excommunicated rather, Berengarius. He didn't kill him, but he lived near Bordeaux, France, and because Berengarius said transubstantiation is not right. Transubstantiation is when you take the Lord's Supper and the wafer in your mouth, it actually becomes the body of Christ. And when the priest lifts up the host, the cup, it becomes the blood of Christ. And he says, this can't be true. The Pope warned him. They brought him to Rome, put him on trial, made him recant that. When he got back home to Bordeaux, France, outside of Bordeaux, he said, I wish I had not done that. I still believe that transubstantiation is wrong. But that was a favorite doctrine of the Catholics at that time. And they excommunicated him. And they said, you shut up and you don't say anything else about this. You just hush. And they put him in a monastery and he had to live the rest of his life and just be quiet. Bless his heart. I think he did the right thing. He knew the truth about this, that was not correct. That was way back in 1050. Now I'm going to skip over several hundred years. In 1380, thank you, Wycliffe made his first translations in English in the Bible. 8 years later, 1388, John Purvey, after Wycliffe had died with a stroke, he updated Wycliffe's Bible. And they finally put the whole Bible in English. 1415, John Huss over in Bohemia had learned about Wycliffe's teaching. How? Some of the students of Wycliffe over there in England brought his teachings over to what then was Bohemia, now Slovakia. And John Huss said, I believe that I can take, and the people can take, the Lord's Supper in both elements, the bread and the fruit of the vine. By then, it was not supposed to be done. Only the people took the wafer, the bread, and only the priest would drink the fruit of the vine. Why? Because an average person might spill the blood of Christ. And so when he said and was brought to Constance to be judged in 1415, they put him on trial and they burned him. They condemned him and burned him at the stake there in Constance. Why? For teaching that people can take both the bread and the fruit of the vine. And forever after that, Mary, Queen of Scots, for instance, who ruled in England as queen, you've heard of her, Bloody Mary, and people taught that they could do this. Even Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, was burned at the stake. Why? They just used the little rule. He believed you could take the elements, both elements. And several other people were killed that same year he was because of that same rule. I think people ought to know these things. Wycliffe's body was dug up in 1428. They kept him and did not allow him to die by burning, but they dug his bones up and they threw the ashes in the Avon River, and the Avon River flowed into the Severn River. The Severn River flowed into the sea, and now the ashes of Wycliffe's body have floated all over the world, and his influence of putting the Bible in the language of the people has also spread all over the world. One of the reasons the Restoration started was the printing press with movable type in 1464. Gutenberg developed that. That means you could quickly multiply books and writings. In 1496, after the Eastern Empire had fallen to the Ottoman Turks, many people left Constantinople with those ancient, valuable Greek manuscripts. And John Collet, the Lord Mayor's son of London, went over to Italy to study those manuscripts. And he learned Greek. And when he got back in 1496 to London, spent only a small time with his parents, then he immediately went up to Oxford and began to lecture in the classroom on Paul's epistles First and Second Corinthians, Romans. And he lectured for 8 years. Here's this young man who learned New Testament Greek, saw these manuscripts. He came back and announced his courses. I'm going to be speaking on this. Other faculty came in and sat in on the lectures. Students flocked to these things. Why? He was teaching them in English what the Greek text said. It was against the law, actually. You could not publish it. They had taken Wycliffe's translations away. But John Colet, hardly ever heard of or mentioned. I think you ought to know about him. Why? Erasmus said, I don't have the money to go over to Italy and look at these manuscripts, but I'm learning Greek. Can I come over to England and study under you, and what's your method? Yes, come on. And King Henry VIII even said, send him up to Cambridge and have him to teach while he's over here. And John Colet revealed to us that Erasmus was already working on his Greek New Testament. These are but a few of the dates that show you some things that were happening that were going to start the Protestant Reformation. When Huss was burned, he said, now you roast a goose. Huss means goose. But 100 years from now, Europe will hear a swan singing, and they will not be able to stop him. About 100 years, Martin Luther nailed those 95 theses up at Wittenberg, and the Reformation began. And though Luther, Zwingli, nor Calvin restored the church, they made some progress that the church could be restored by those who wanted to start struggling to go all the way back. I'll give you some information on some things that this lesson conveys in the process of the week, maybe today. Thank you for your good attention. We're glad to have you here in this series.